From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in this morning's opening forum hour, today marks the 10th anniversary of the United States invasion of Iraq, and as part of our series In My Experience, which spotlights personal stories of local residents, we talk with four people whose lives have been profoundly affected by the Iraq War. Our guests include Haltham Jazim, Iraqi immigrant and former translator for the U.S. Marines, Elizabeth Elias, military spouse whose husband served in Iraq, Karen Meredith, mother of Lieutenant Ken Ballard, who was killed in Iraq, and Mike Ligori, U.S. Marine, who served two tours in Iraq. Forum is next. We invite you to join us for the hour after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum program. And today marks the 10-year anniversary of the invasion of Iraq. Yesterday, we spent the opening hour discussing the war and policies with the war. And this morning, we talked to people who were personally affected by it. As part of our ongoing series, In My Experience, we welcome a number of people to the microphones this hour who are here in the Bay Area. And first, let me introduce Karen Meredith, whose son, First Lieutenant Ken Ballard, was killed in Iraq. Welcome, Karen Meredith.
Good morning.
Good morning. And you're a Gold Star mother, and my condolences and the loss of your son. He went off to Iraq. Why?
Ken had been in the Army since he graduated from high school in 95. And he joined the Army, as I said, right out of high school. It was something he always wanted to do. He was actually a fourth-generation Army, ultimately an Army officer. And he joined, went off to Bosnia and Macedonia and Germany, and then listened to his mother and went to college on an Army scholarship. So he was commissioned as an officer in May of 2002.
He was a tank commander and platoon leader.
Correct.
But in Germany, you knew probably he was going to the desert, even though, as I understand, the recruiter said no deployment.
Well, he joined in 95, so he had already been deployed to Bosnia. But when he got out of college, then he went back. No, I told him that his orders to Germany meant one step closer to the desert. So we knew he was going.
And he wound up in Najaf.
Najaf, yes.
And that was in 2004, killed in Najaf?
Correct.
And talk about what you know about his death and what actually happened to him.
Well, we were first told on Memorial Day morning that he was killed by insurgent fire. A single gunshot wound to the head is what they told me ultimately. And 15 months later, the Army came to me and told me that it was an accidental death, that he was backing up his tank near midnight, so it was dark, and Ken was out of the commander's hatch, had ordered his loader to get down because they were still taking incoming fire. That let the M240 machine gun, it wasn't locked. So when they turned the vehicle, a tree branch brushed against the machine gun and killed Ken immediately.
And there was an investigation because they gave you the wrong information?
Correct. They didn't tell me for 15 months, and everybody knew.
And you were always opposed to the war. I mean, in fact, after you became a peace activist, too.
Mm-hmm.
And what set you off was, I think, as I understand it, Secretary Rumsfeld's auto condolences.
Yeah. Yes, he had said for months and months that, nope, I'm signing them all. And finally, in December of 2004, he admitted that he didn't because he wanted to make sure the letters were sent to the families quickly. And that night, I went out and spoke at a rally.
Some of your speeches have been quite uplifting. I mean, not only because you spoke of your son lovingly and as a mother would, as a good man, and but also as everyone's son. What do you mean by that, everyone's son?
Well, because this country, for these wars and an all-volunteer military, it's 1% of the country that is carrying 100% of the burden of these wars. So most people don't, especially in the beginning, didn't know anybody who was serving. So Ken could have been anybody's son. He could have been somebody that you grew up watching on your child's soccer team. And so he was and still is to a lot of people because he is still the only one that they knew in the military.
And Mountain View is naming a post office after your son.
They are.
That's nice honoring of him. And what do you feel about the war now when you look back?
I haven't changed. I was talking earlier that things will never be better in my life without my son. Ken was my only child. But things get different and you accept things. But this recently, as people are talking about this 10-year anniversary, and we're hearing from politicians, we're hearing from journalists, oh, I should have done this, I would have done that if I knew. Those are the people that should have known and should have answered the questions. So this hasn't been a very good week for me.
Well, I'm sorry again for your loss. And
thank you
for joining us this morning. Karen Meredith, her son, First Lieutenant Ken Ballard, killed in Iraq. Mike Liguori is with us. He served two tours in Iraq as a Marine between 2004 and 2006. He was a First Lieutenant. Actually wrote a book about it called The Sandbox, Stories of Human Spirit and War. And Mike, good to have you here.
Hey, thanks, Mike.
We actually met at Swords to Plowshares and came up and presented me the book. And the book says pretty much why you went there. You went there for revenge, but also kind of to prove yourself, didn't you?
Yeah, I went to serve my country. At that time, being a 17-year-old high school senior with no direction in their life, the events of September 11th really dramatically affected me.
Which is what I meant by revenge. Yeah.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
And the sense was, this is 2002 when you enlisted.
Yeah? Correct.
The sense was that you would go over there and you would serve your country.
I was going to, I was determined to seek revenge on those that, you know, that committed those atrocities. And I felt that it was my duty to not only seek that kind of revenge, but also to step up to the plate and, you know, the call to arms.
You also, as I read your book, became aware of the fact you wanted to show your mettle and your courage and that you could withstand firefights and all that sort of thing, heroic kind of fights.
Yeah, I figured that, you know, the only way I was going to be able to show that I actually had done something was to have something, you know, that was concrete, a medal or, you know, a citation or something where I could show my friends that I truly was a war hero.
And that was important. Why?
Well, I think at that time, you know, that was what I felt, you know, judging before I had actually enlisted, that, you know, that's what you see in war, is that you see these, you know, in the movies, actually, that you see the depiction of war is that, you know, you see men and women wearing uniforms and the medals hanging from their chest. And, you know, I kind of figured that when you see the people standing in awe of them, it was kind of like, well, maybe that's what I think is a definition of a war hero, was that I was going to have these medals hanging off my chest and people were going to be in awe of me for that call to action.
And the story is, came home, it was hard coming home, actually lost your faith, got PTSD. I mean, there's the story and
yeah,
the trajectory.
Yeah, that was not advertised when I joined. That was something I was completely unaware of. And in 2006, it was a very difficult transition for me.
But back to the war itself, I mean, in many ways, it was a good experience in terms of the connectedness with your fellow soldiers, becoming family.
The sense of camaraderie is something that is not easily replicated. And I, for one, will never, ever regret, regardless of the opinions of the war, I will never regret my service. I will never regret my experiences, good and bad.
Well, talk about the opinions of the war, though. I mean, when you were fighting the war, were you questioning it with other soldiers as particularly information came out about the fact that there were no weapons of mass destruction? Now we know, by the way, according to a new BBC report, you may want to respond to this, that top sources were informed months before the invasion that Iraq had no active WMD program, none. It describes, actually, the BBC program, how Saddam's foreign minister told the CIA station chief, whose name was Bill Murray at the time, through an intermediary, that they were virtually nothing in terms of WMDs.
Yeah, I mean—
So you were lied to, essentially.
guess so. But I think one of those things, too, is when I was part of a motor transport unit, and a lot of the times there was intelligence being, you know, brought down to us from battalion. And a lot of the times they would tell us that there was very little mention of WMDs because that wasn't our mission. So it was more of our job was to resupply all the forward operating units in the Al-Anbar province. So when it ever came up to WMDs, they liked to deflect the conversation. It was kind of like, so, you know, if you were to kind of talk about it amongst your peers and say, you know, well, aren't we supposed to be here for these weapons of mass destruction? you know, and then they would kind of hear about it. Or you would kind of ask them an indirect question about it. They would kind of like to deflect and kind of veer off and let's stay on track with the intelligence that's being, you know, given here during the convoy brief. So it was kind of interesting.
Well, you felt you were liberating these people too, didn't you? Bringing democracy to them?
Absolutely. I mean, I was there for 3 out of the 4 elections that they had. And when I got to see that, one of the greatest accomplishments of my tours of service was watching the Iraqi people actually get to vote, standing in line and waiting hours and hours just to put a yes or a no, a do you approve of the Constitution. And it was a very powerful experience. It's a very humbling experience.
There's also a lot of soldiers who report that they were there as warriors and they were there to liberate and so forth. But then suddenly it was like you wanted to make friends with the Iraqi people. You wanted to be there for goodwill and to foster good tidings and, you know, present the United States in a positive way. And those two things were sometimes really strongly contradictory.
Yeah, I mean, because you were, you know, after the major combat operations had ended, I believe it was in 2004.
That's right.
Then I showed up 6 months afterwards. So they had now deemed it, the administration had deemed it the peacekeeping and humanitarian effort. So when they tell you that it's peacekeeping humanitarian efforts, there's no aggressive assaults. It's very defensive tactics. Your mindset becomes more defensive. If the people of Iraq do need you, you are there to serve and help the Iraqi people, not to go and clear the buildings and, you know, go take out the insurgent strongholds. So it was interesting, though, because even though they had deemed that, that was still going on around the city of Fallujah and still going around Baghdad and the Sunni triangle that was going on at that time.
And just another sense of your coming home, which I know was tough for you, not only readjusting to life as a civilian, but also feeling depressed and going through what a lot of vets go through. And as you know, I've worked through years with Swords to Plowshares, so I'm well aware of those kinds of problems and how severe and in your case, profound they can be. But you found a lot of purpose in working with the Wounded Warrior Project, and many of those former combatants have gone through this same kind of cycle.
Yeah, I mean, groups like Wounded Warrior Project and the Iraq-Afghanistan Veterans of America, those were groups that it was the first time in my transition home after 2006. It was the first time in my transition home I was able to not have to explain myself to other people that didn't serve. Immediately, there was an instant connection with other veterans who had served in Iraq and Afghanistan, and we already knew what each other had gone through. And because of that, it made it a lot easier to talk about other things. There was an instant bond and friendship. And so that kind of led things to be a little bit easier for me when I went to go volunteer my service and participate in last year's IAVA, as Iraq-Afghanistan Veterans of America is called for short, their Storm the Hill campaign, which is a lobbying event that they do once a year on Capitol Hill. And that was a life-changing experience for me, and it gave me just a better sense of purpose.
And Karen Meredith, every year, Memorial Day, you and other mothers get together, other families, members get together. Yeah.
Yes. Ken is buried at Arlington, and we go back and get to ride with Rolling Thunder, which is pretty fun. And then on Monday for Memorial Day, we meet at Ken's grave and celebrate his life, drink champagne, and tell tall tales.
And again, Karen Meredith's son, First Lieutenant Ken Ballard, was killed in Iraq. Haytham Jassim is also with us this hour, and welcome him back to Forum. Good to have you here, an Iraqi immigrant and former translator with the U.S. Marines, who left in 2008, now lives in San Jose. Your experience over there was pretty extraordinary in many ways. I mean, you were with them in every sense of the word.
Thank you very much, Mike, to have me back. Sorry.
Throat okay?
Yeah.
Okay. Come on up.
Thank
to
you.
The microphone. Yeah, I mean, when I say you were with them in every sense of the way, under fire constantly, and actually, like many journalists who are embedded, you were embedded.
Well, it was difficult and complicated in the same time. And I didn't realize the American sides, how complicated for them to serve. I mean, your question to Mike that, how you, you know, serve and at the same time being aggressive and, you know, to have this kind of complicated relationship. I didn't realize that till I got when I was on the convoy and the hammer that I was with inside it get an ID in our way in Haditha, and the lieutenant actually the lieutenant at that time was like very confused, and he was like looking at me and looking at the hole in the middle of the road, and he was like asking me loudly, I don't get it. I don't understand. The people who, you know, planted this, same people from this country, while you are from the same country, how you are working with us and, you know, serving with us and helping, while the others, like, trying to kill us and kill you at the same time. I don't get this idea.
Well, it was certainly true in your case. I mean, there you were helping the American war effort, and you had many who probably wanted to kill you because of that, yeah?
Absolutely. They consider me like I betrayed them or something like that.
Here we call it Benedict Arnold, you know, or Judas Iscariot. I mean, you were a traitor to them, right?
I mean, my goal when I work with the U.S. military is to help my people in the first place, to make sure there is no confusion between someone who has a gun and someone who might be not, you know, understand the language. I mean, the culture and language barrier, it's a big obstacle between someone who has a gun and who has no gun, and under the power of that, you know, second party. So that was my main goal. And when I worked with the Americans from the first time till now, I'm still convinced of what I did. I will never regret what I did.
What do you think about the fact that this government is now run by Maliki and Shiites? American forces are almost gone, except for State Department people. I mean, the country has been transformed.
It's really sad.
And there's more violence there, by the way, than there is in Afghanistan, I want to add to. Yeah.
Well, I heard in the way that there is another bomb in Baghdad today.
Just today,
in
that's right.
It's really sad that people who is in the power, they don't have that much of experience to, you know, to be politicians. I mean, they are regular people, never been in that position before. They are, you know, learning it the hard way while people under their power suffering, I mean, the people of Iraq. And the other sad story that countries surrounding the Iraq are influencing whoever inside the country to take over the power. So it's like the neighbors of Iraq fighting each other through the Iraqi people. And, yeah.
And you came here with a special visa, a special immigrant visa, and it's been rough in many ways adjusting to American life, hasn't it?
For me, in the beginning, it wasn't. And I guess it's still. But for my wife, it wasn't easy to, you know. She was struggling because she lost her friends, her family bond. And the Iraqi culture is like rely on your environment, your neighbors, your
community.
Family. Yeah. Absolutely. While here is everybody busy, even the Iraqi themselves, Iraq community, they are busy, refugees busy. They wanted someone to help them, not someone just to chit-chat with them and, you know, pass the time. While for myself, I didn't feel that I have any difficulties to adjust in the life here till, like, I felt like I burned in my work while I was working with the Center for Survival Torture, and I'm still. But my boss looked at me and she said, you are burning. You need to have some time off because you have kind of depression and all the symptoms I can see, it's like obvious, while you can't see. From my point of view, I see nothing but I need to work, and that's it. Maybe that's kind of avoidance, which is the PTSD, one of the symptoms.
It sounds like PTSD, what you went through. You were also living in Oakland, and sometimes it seemed like you were in Iraq living in Oakland.
No, I'm not in Oakland.
Oh, you're not in San Jose, I'm sorry.
I'm San Jose. But
you were in Oakland for a while, no?
No, actually, but I'm in contact with the Iraqi refugees in Oakland. I hear their stories and news, and they like change the challenge they've been through with the same challenge in Oakland, actually. I mean, there were many, at least three incidents happened to three Iraqi refugees beaten up or someone, one of them actually killed in Oakland. And two of them recently had been beaten up till they left between life and death there. They brought here without obvious, information where they are living and what the environment. They came from a country that the system there is government system, while here it's completely different. It's a democratic system. And they believe that whatever the agencies told them or the government, this is God's word.
Haytham Jazim again here with us in studio, an Iraqi immigrant, former translator with U.S. Marines who left in 2008 and now, as I said, lives in San Jose. Elizabeth Elias is also with us this morning by phone. Her husband served in Iraq in 2007-2008. She's with us this morning in Salinas. Welcome, Elizabeth Elias.
Thank you.
Well, let's find out about your story. I was thinking about recruiter lying about deployment. That was the case with your husband, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, when when we were thinking about him signing up, I was very reluctant because I'm a very clingy wife. I was a very clingy girlfriend, and I couldn't imagine being without him. And
you just got married, in fact, right?
Yeah. Well, we were engaged when we decided that he should sign up. We were married for 6 weeks before he left to boot camp, And then we basically didn't live together for like the next year.
Tough for a clingy wife, huh?
Very tough for a clingy wife. Very tough.
So lonely and difficult and all that, huh?
Yeah. I mean, I stayed back in our hometown while he was at basic training. And then when he went to AIT, his job training, I moved down to Arizona where we didn't get to live together. And I mean, technically, I wasn't even authorized, I guess, to go down there. So I lived off post. He lived in the barracks. We saw each other very rarely. And then right after his job training was done, he was sent off to Afghanistan.
And coming back for him was also difficult in many ways, although he got a good deal as far as the GI Bill, didn't he?
Yes. I mean, that is the main reason that we decided that it would be good for us to join. First of all, we thought that, that he would have a steady job for his 5-year contract. We were told that the job that he would have was a non-deployable job. And so we thought, hey, this is a great way to, to provide for our family for now and for him to get an education debt-free after his contract was through.
But I'm getting ahead of the story here somewhat because after Afghanistan, of course, how long was he in Iraq?
15 months.
And how did that experience compare for him to Afghanistan, for example?
Well, he was only in Afghanistan for 3 months. And so I'm not really sure that he even was able to get his feet underneath what he was supposed to be doing. I mean, that seems like such a short time to transition and, really become part of the team. And he went over individually, so he didn't go over with a group of people that he knew. He was just kind of embedded into a team that was already over there. But when he went to Iraq, it was with people who he'd known for, for years. And they worked really well together. And, they had a really clear plan and really clear leadership. He knew more what to expect.
And I'm coming up on a break here, but a lot of his enlisting had to do with 9/11 too, didn't it?
Well, more it was for him to be able to provide for our family and for him to get a debt-free education.
Okay. So just want to get that straight because there were a lot of enlistments for that. I'm going to give out the number and invite those of you listening, whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, to join the program. We'd like to hear your own personal experiences with Iraq in any way you want to narrate them. Just be cogent and feel free to join us. Toll-free number available now, 866-733-6786. Again, our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or email forum at kqed.org. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Today marks the 10th anniversary of the United States invasion of Iraq, and yesterday we spoke about policies and the war itself. Today, as part of my experience series, we're spotlighting personal stories of people who live in the Bay Area and are local here in Northern California, talking with four people whose lives have been profoundly affected by the Iraq War. And we want to hear your stories as well and invite you to join our conversation or let us know how the war affected you, whether it had to do with your serving or whether it had to do with your having a family member who served or even if you were there in Iraq in some capacity, contractor or whatever. And again, you can join us at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum at kqed.org, or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. or go to our Facebook page. You can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is at KQED Forum, but certainly we'd like to hear from you and like to hear your stories. Again, Karen Meredith with us in studio, whose son, First Lieutenant Ken Ballard, was killed in Iraq, and Mike Ligori served two tours in Iraq as a Marine between 2004 and 2006 and wrote a book called The Sandbox, Stories of Human Spirit and War. Haytham Jazim with us also is an Iraqi immigrant, former translator for the U.S. Marines who left Iraq in 2008 and now is living in San Jose. And Elizabeth Elias, whose husband served in Iraq from 2007 to 2008. And Elizabeth, I want to go back to you and just kind of flesh out your story more about having kids and how that all developed while your husband was serving.
Sure. Well, we were married in 2004. We had our first daughter here in Monterey in 2006. And, you know, that was a really happy time with for us because, you know, we were together. He was in school and, you know, with the military. He was at DLI. And then once he was through with that, we were stationed to North Carolina. And shortly after that, we got pregnant with our second daughter, and by the time I was 4 months pregnant, he was gone. He was gone with his team to Iraq, and so, you know, I was there doing it alone. I had my small one-year-old, and I did my whole pregnancy basically by myself, and had a baby by myself, did the first 6 months of her life by myself. And, you know, it was hard. It was really tough, but it's one of those things that, you get through it 'cause you have to. You don't really have another choice. You gotta pick up and carry on and hope that things get better.
And what about your relationship of, your husband with his children, especially since, you were essentially doing the upbringing?
I was, yeah, for, you know, that first 6 months of her life, our second daughter's life, she didn't know her dad. And so he came home for his R&R, and which was, you know, just a few week break. And when she first met him, she loved him. She thought he was the best. And they, you know, they got along great and they had a lot of fun together and they bonded really quickly. And it was fantastic. And then, you know, he left again. And he was only gone for a few more months after his R&R, so he gets back about 3 months later, you know, home for good. And she didn't want to bond. She didn't want to bond with him again. It was kind of like, you know, she looked at him. She's like, I remember you, and I remember that you left, so I'm going to be on guard for now. And I'm not, you know, it took her about 6 weeks before she really even paid him the time of day. And even now, you know, she's five and she loves him and they have a great relationship, but it's just not the same. She needs her mom. Mom is always the safe place and the solid place. And she knows that I'm not going anywhere, even though she should have that knowledge with him too. 'Cause you know, he hasn't gone anywhere for the past 4 years, but it's tough on her.
And again, Elizabeth Elias, whose husband served in Iraq 2007-2008. Life is somewhat normal now, and he got an education. Where did he go with that?
Yeah, life is really normal now. It's good. He, when his contract ended in 2009, we came back to California, where we're both from, and he went to CSU Monterey Bay. He got his degree in business, concentration in marketing, and now he is on the job hunt currently, and we're, you know, looking to stay in the area. We love it. We love California. We love being here. So,
well, good luck to you, and we thank you.
You
for sharing. And I say this to all of our guests this morning, for sharing their stories. And let me bring our callers in who, in some cases, have stories to share as well or joining our conversation. Ellen, good morning.
Good morning. The pressure to be cogent is overwhelming here. I just had a comment and a question. I had been in Saudi Arabia as the director of the U.S. Refugee program there after the first Gulf War, where there are hundreds of thousands of refugees, Shia refugees, who had fled Iraq. And then after we invaded Iraq, I took a delegation over to Syria and Jordan to look at the refugee situation that had been created. There are about 2.5 million refugees who fled Iraq as a result of our going into Iraq and Haitham High. And I'm just wondering, you know, you start the show with the comment that it's, you know, now a stated fact, a known fact, that we went in under false pretenses. So I'm wondering how people feel when they've been so deeply affected and had such extreme loss as a result of actions that we took that were based on lies.
Well, certainly we touched on this with Karen Meredith. Mike Liguori, let me go to you on this.
Yeah, thanks for your comment. It's a little bit difficult at times because you, at that moment during when September 11th happened and then you enlist the following year, you think that was the right thing to do. You know, and you went to the recruiter and, you know, they told you it was America against the war on terrorism. That's what they had deemed it. And so, you know, when you're this 18-year-old kid, I mean, it's, you know, that's kind of like those two words, America and war on terrorism, and you're going to be a part of it. And, you know, that was all that kind of rang true to me. You know, looking back on it now, the military was, and the Marine Corps especially, was a wonderful experience. But as you were saying before, it is difficult under false pretenses. But I don't regret my service at all, regardless if it was it's true or false.
Well, we'll hear from the other guests on this, but I'm looking at an email here from a listener who says, how can those of us who didn't support the war effort and still don't show our support for those who served and those who died in Iraq? And Karen, can I go to you on that?
Sure. I think that people who didn't support the war, as I did not, need to remember that our administration, our country, sent those young men and women over there, and we have to support them. They didn't necessarily go to war. They didn't necessarily want to fight, but they were doing their job, and they were serving their country, which I can't say about a lot of the people in this country anymore.
Elizabeth Elias, how do you and your husband feel about, the fact that this nation and citizens were lied to, and that your service may have been, you know, very bona fide and genuine in terms of your husband, but nevertheless, people wonder, in their opposition to the war, why did he serve? How did he serve?
Well, you know, I think that I just really try to give people the benefit of the doubt. and I don't know, I mean, given that, you know, lies were told and perhaps we went over there under false pretenses, I like to believe that we are doing good, or at least have done some good. I mean, I think that I kind of have to believe that to not just be so angry with all of the sacrifices made and all of the people's lives who've been forever changed. And yeah, I don't know.
Haytham Jazem, your thoughts on this, especially since you were there, as I said, very much a part of the war effort.
Well, I don't feel that the reason for involved in a war would be like revenge or something like that. It would be more reasonable to think about it as like to have peaceful for the people that you are serving for. It's when had been mentioned before earlier that 1% is serving on behalf of 100%. It shouldn't be, involved in violence. It shouldn't be, think or believe in guns or doing things by war. However, if it's the last choice, you need to do it. I mean, you need to have your peace for your country, for your people, and even for the people that you are going to help them, like in Iraq and Afghan case. If you leave them that way, it may involve other countries.
Should we go in and help Syria?
Syria is a similar case to Iraq. It's proved that, and somehow, regardless of my opinion, helping or not helping, it's proved that what's happening in Iraq, it should happen because people have no power to stand against dictatorship. That's my point.
Again, we'd like to hear your personal stories, and feel free to join us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org. Here's a listener who writes on our website, which is also a way to communicate with us, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. Powerful testimony from Mike. Breaks my heart to hear Miss Meredith talk about what this particular week is like for her. Grateful they're sharing their experiences on this show. Can't be easy for them to do this, but so important. I would echo that. And let me go to a caller. Rebecca from Geyserville. Hi.
Yes, I wanted to ask the mother who lost her son if she felt that people like Rumsfeld, who so poorly managed the war, if they should be caught up on criminal charges. Thank you. That's my question.
Okay, thank you. Karen Meredith, would you like to see Donald Rumsfeld and other members of the war-making policymakers prosecuted, accountable?
I was with a group of peace people several years ago. I think it was in 2005. And I said my fantasy would be to see them all do the perp walk. I would like to see them brought up on charges, all of them.
Beth writes, having multiple family members who have done multiple tours of duty in Iraq and Afghanistan, I guess it just concerns me that most Americans have no idea what these men and women have been through and seen, much of which they do not talk about unless it's with family who also have known active duty, war tours in the past. Makes me so sad and makes me even question, what have the dead died for? The living left maimed in some way when you see a country like Iraq reverting back to the old ways once we leave. Another listener writes on our web, thank you for this topic. Thank you to all your guests for sharing. I lost my childhood best friend in Iraq on November 9, 2004, Sergeant David Caruso, USMC Force Reconnaissance. The war was stupid, but his service was courageous. And John writes, my thanks to all of you on the program this morning, and particularly those so personally affected. As an Army vet, I'm sorry, but when I see pictures of Cheney and Bush and their still completely incomprehensive hubris, my grief is in the disconnection. Enough said. He adds, a legacy is what you live every day. Mike, let me talk to you a little bit about what I alluded to before. You lost your faith in Iraq. Found it when you came back here?
Yeah.
Again,
that's,
or found it in a different way?
Yeah, that was correct. I grew up a very devout Christian as a child. And so a lot of that, you know, the Marine Corps really attracted me because it was God, country, core. And so that was kind of the three things that were the most important to me at that time. After a couple months in my first tour in Iraq, from the time that I enlisted all the way until my first tour in Iraq, I had prepared myself to be in this mindset that I was going to be this cold-blooded, hardened warrior, killer, because that was what I was trained to do, was to go to war. And I had practiced getting into that mode. I had kind of almost embodied everything about the Marine Corps, this aggressive assault behavior that was kind of instilled in me. When I went to Iraq, I was like a shark in the water. I was like looking for blood. I was waiting for my first time to experience my first firefight and, you know, get shot at, because we were talking about it earlier, it was about the medals for me. And that was one of the part of the reasons why I joined. But there was a night in, you know, November, December timeframe, about 3-4 months in, that we were driving through this village in the northern part of the province called Al-Qaim, which is right next to, it's a little bit north of Haditha. And we were coming back late one night, and there was a small child that was about 150 meters from me. And as a part of our convoy, I had kind of gone through this village late at night. He proceeded, this small child, to throw what it looked like a rock to me. And, you know, I didn't think of anything of it. It was kind of weird that a child was by himself in the middle of the night. And as I got closer to it, a couple seconds later, that rock that I had seen exploded. And preceding that, 15 seconds later, there was another explosion. And soon there was rounds coming over my head. And at 20 years old, at that time, I felt like I had aged to 40. And in addition to that, I also thought it was a training exercise. And I realized I was getting shot at. I was going, holy crap, I'm getting shot at right now. And this is what it was like.
Suddenly you were hit with the reality of war.
Oh, yeah. And it came on really, really strong. Thank God nobody during that 30-second incident, that nobody died or was injured. But when I got back to base, I cried. I kind of shook in fear. And I remember smoking a half a pack of cigarettes in probably about a couple hours. And I had realized that my faith-based religion, where I was told to believe in, you know, Christianity, and that it was that God and Jesus were there, I had never seen God or Jesus. But what I had seen was the atrocities and the horrors of war. And that to me was more real than my faith in Christianity that I had grown up with the whole time. And that's where I started losing my faith.
And regained it? How?
In 2010, I had gone after through all my roller coaster, as I like to call it. 2010, I had decided that I didn't want to live anymore. And it was very difficult for me because I was in therapy at that time. I was dealing with a lot of personal issues with post-traumatic stress, moderate depression, and it was severe to moderate and fluctuated. And I was in my kitchen, and I decided I was just going to cut myself. I was going to end it, and the pain and everything that I had gone through my whole entire life was going to disappear. At the moment in time when I thought I was going to go through with this, and I had this, you know, what seemed like to me wasn't an elaborate plan, I remember looking at the knives in my drawer, and I went to reach it, and just before I went to grab one of the knives, I couldn't do it. And I felt the room get really, really quiet, almost very similar to the quiet right before you get shot at or you know something bad, the calming before the storm. And I remember sitting there looking at that knife and closing my eyes and hearing this voice in my right ear. And I will never forget this for the rest of my life, but there was a voice that told me to put the knife down. It is not your time to go. And I truly believe at that moment, after that voice had repeated itself over and over again, that I had truly realized that after 4 years of ducking and dodging my faith in Christianity or my faith in a God-based religion or anything, that God had reappeared and made himself available to me as a friend, as a comforter, as a father figure to me, and gave me another chance to live my life. Because he had said, you have purpose here in your life to help other people, to help your fellow veterans, to help yourself. So at the moment when I needed faith the most and war wasn't available to me, God had reappeared and made himself available.
Or maybe your unconscious was speaking too. Yeah, directly. I mean, that's another more secular interpretation.
Absolutely.
But whatever moves you to put that knife down, I'm glad you did. Karen Meredith, was your faith shaken? You stayed with the church and all, haven't you?
Nope.
No?
Nope. I was raised Catholic, and I was angry with God. I'm still angry with God. I have a hard time with it.
How about you, Haytham? You were brought up Muslim?
Yes.
And
I never have my faith shaken before. I mean, with the worst time, I always think that God is there for me. And being Shia, that's even more strength would be brought to me because we have like 12 imam to believe in. And I was like always believe in them. I mean, the moment the IED had been exploded at that time, I was like seeing the death right in front of my face. It was like, you know, few...
It's like a vision?
It's like really flashback, really, really fast. You never sense it. But God was there for me always. And I always, in the hard moment, tough moment, I always think that God is there for me. Otherwise, I'm not going to live.
Elizabeth, you're a Mormon.
I am, yeah.
And can your husband continue to cleave to your faith?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it was a big, I think a big help and a big comfort while he was gone to know that, you know, even if the unthinkable did happen, even if he didn't make it back home, that you know, we would be taken care of, that we would be okay, that we would see each other again in the next life. And definitely being part of such a worldwide church, you know, the gospel's the same everywhere. We could leave our congregation here in California and, you know, go find the exact same gospel being taught in North Carolina and have the same camaraderie and the same friendships and the same support with people, you know, that we just met, that we'd known for a couple weeks. They would still, you know, come over and mow my lawn and clean out my gutters. And while I was gigantically pregnant, they would get, you know, all my boxes out of the attic so I could decorate for Christmas and, you know, do all that stuff for me that I needed help with.
And let me bring another caller on. Jay, thanks for waiting. Join us, please.
Good morning. How are you doing today?
Thank you. Okay.
Yeah, so I was with the 94th Engineer Combat Battalion Heavy, attached under the 3AD 11th Engineers. My platoon actually did one of the borders on the, or one of the breaches on the border between Iraq and Kuwait. And I can absolutely identify with what one of your guests said that, you know, when the stuff hits the fan, you can definitely rely on your training. Your training kicks in. You train like you fight, and you fight like you train.
And your memories?
Well,
for the most part?
Well, they're all over the place. You know, Iraq was, for me at least, before, because we got there during the initial invasion, it was still a very beautiful country. And but, you know, it's beauty, it's horror, it's everything.
And how do you feel now in light of this 10-year anniversary? Any particular feelings that you can locate?
Well, it's been bringing up a lot of interesting memories, and thankfully I have a couple of really good friends that were over there as well that I'm able to talk to. Unfortunately, some of my family members that had been in previous wars had passed away, so I can't rely on them anymore to talk to them. But it really does... with the family, bring up a huge, or I shouldn't say huge, but it brings up a wedge because it's a huge experience that you have in your life that it's difficult to impossible to really convey to people that haven't been there and done that.
Yeah, I think that's pretty much what Mike Ligori was saying, and thank you for your call. I'm looking at some emails here that I wanted to read. Andrew writes, "Howdy, Michael. Thanks as always for your program. I'm an Iraq War veteran who served during the initial invasion with the U.S. Marines, and I consider that night 10 years ago waiting in the desert for President Bush to give the green light as the end of my life in many ways. I have since managed to scrape together a decent career in life, but have spent the last 10 years at times homeless, at times alcoholic, and at times angry. I am one of thousands like me. The public reason for the war is now universally considered to be a lie. At what point do we, as a nation, get justice for the immense damage that lie has done to us, both individually and economically? I can get a ticket for jaywalking, but a group of individuals who mislead us into the loss of thousands of lives and permanent injuring of tens of thousands more get away without so much as a warning. Seems like the same story we hear all the time, but at what point does someone yell out, the emperor isn't wearing any clothes?" Karen, a question from you for a listener. What was your son like? Can you tell us about him?
I raised Ken on my own, so we had a really special bond, and it was great that I was actually going to turn 50 the year that Ken was killed, and I was going to go over to Germany. We were going to travel together, and he was going to be my tour guide because I was born in Germany, but he had done much more exploring. So he was a great guy. To this day, almost 9 years later, I have not heard one person say anything bad about him. And I think that speaks to his legacy and who he was as an officer, as a friend. But everybody loved him.
And what do you want people to think about on this day? What do you want them, if anything, to sort of focus on as far as their thoughts or feelings are concerned?
Well, I hope that people, as the email that you just read, I hope that people will understand that we have got to hold our government accountable for the things that they do in our name. It is in our name. And if you don't tell people that you don't like what they're doing, then they're going to think it's okay. And even though millions of people protested before the war this week, 10 years ago, our government did not listen to us, and we've got to become more vocal, especially because so many people in this country were not directly affected by the war and still aren't.
And Haytham Jazem, what would you like people to think of on this 10-year anniversary or feel?
I'd like them to think about refugees that had been displaced all over the world because of that war, regardless if that war was for good or bad. Because it's a fact and result of that war anyway.
And orphans, too? I mean, there are thousands and thousands of orphans as a result of the war, too.
Absolutely. Inside the country, even outside the country. I mean, refugees are not like living forever everywhere. but they are suffering. They may lose their lives in some point till they ended up in the third country or their destination.
And can I go to you, Elizabeth Elias?
Oh, sure.
10-year anniversary. Oh. What do you want people to think or feel?
I don't know. I haven't really thought about this. I guess just cherish the moments that you have with the people that you love, because you never know. You never know what the future holds, and it's helpful to have those fond memories to look back on when you need to get through the hard parts.
Mike Ligori.
10 years after the start of the war, I think the one thing that I would like people to remember is the fact that regardless if you were for or against the war, or, you know, whatever the studies came out, just remember that there were millions of people affected by it, particularly the refugees and also especially to the American soldiers and the veterans. They are still to this day, me being one of them, facing a incredible amount of problems from the backlog claim to homelessness to employment. And it's just very important that the best thing you can do for a veteran is just listen and try to help in any way you can. And just, I think that'd be the best way to remember the war.
Well, I thank you all for being here with us. Mike, thank you for your service. And Elizabeth, thank you for your husband's service. And Karen, for your sons. And for yours, Haytham. Thank you all for being with us again. We've been privileged to talk to Karen Meredith, whose son, First Lieutenant Ken Ballard, was killed in Iraq, with Mike Ligori, who served two terms in Iraq as a Marine, Haytham Jassim, Iraqi immigrant and former translator with the Marines, and Elizabeth Elias, whose husband served in Iraq as well. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. We always welcome your comments, and you can continue this discussion on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Annie Bringer. Our engagement producer, Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.